Time for your weekly smart look at sports. Class is in session. Welcome to The Classroom, originating live from the Marist College Center for Sports Communication in Poughkeepsie. My name's Jeff Brault. I'm hanging out with Dr. Keith Strudler. He runs this place, and Mike Wallace is back after a one-week absence. He's running the board. What's going on, Mike?
Nothing much, just running the board.
I like how you had to think about that.
Let me do an inventory here. Nothing much. Not much going on.
Here's what's coming up on the program today. We are in the middle. I think we're in the middle. Are we in the middle of the Tour de France?
Yeah, we're right there. I think. I don't know. I'll have to look up the stages. It's like a 20-day race, so I know we're pretty close to it.
So Keith Strudler loves cycling.
Yes.
Loves it.
In fact, not only I love it so much, I rode my bike up here today.
I don't get it. In fact, before we went on the air, I made some points about how you could make the Tour de France interesting to regular people.
You made some points about how we could ruin the sport of cycling and dismantle everything that's good about it.
That's the discussion we're going to have a little bit later today.
You'd be like, I know how we can make the Tour de France great. Have them chased by lions.
I'll be honest, I would watch.
That would be a lot more fun.
Now, I'll tell you what. Over the long haul, I like the cyclists. But the first 20, 30 yards, you got to give the lions a little edge.
One thing we love on this program.
Sprinters really do well in that one. It's really bad if you don't have the turnover.
Loyal listeners know that on this program, we love money. And the UFC sold for a whole bunch of it this week. $4 billion. It's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. It is a lot of cha-ching. And we'll see. I'm not sure it's worth it, but I guess that's something we will find out. But I think we've said before, I think this was a good time to cash out if you're on the receiving end of that venture.
Dana White doing pretty well for himself now. I think he made about $390 million from the sale, and he retains 9% of any future profits. That's
always
not bad.
You know what? That's like a Shark Tank deal. He's getting the royalties.
He's got a little Mark Cuban and a little Mr. Wonderful.
So that's the way to do it. You know, because Mr. Wonderful always wants the royalties. He always wants the royalties.
That's his deal. He wants his money to make money.
Yeah, he wants his money. I never get why you would do the deal with Mr. Wonderful, because he's like, look, I will give you the money, but you have to pay me back until I get my entire investment back.
Well, usually it's until he gets his entire investment back tripled.
Right, and then I get a royalty. And I still own a percentage. Like, there's no – I mean, he's just a loan shark.
Yes. So his premise is if you believe in yourself and you believe in your product, the equity should be worth more than the royalty. That's his, you know, thought process.
But he's not putting much skin in the game because he's almost guaranteeing he gets his money back.
Well, he is guaranteed. That's his point. He's so like, I'm going to guarantee I get my money back. And he's also offering his expertise and his guidance.
Yes, but the other people aren't asking for that.
Right.
Very rarely do you see Barbara. Barbara does it every now and then. Very rarely do you see that happen from the other people. Mark Cuban doesn't do it. Damon doesn't do it.
Well, the question becomes, what's going to be worth more to you in the long run? Is it 20% of your company? If you have a multi-million dollar company, the equity is going to be worth more than the 25 cents a product or whatever the royalty is. However, if you're like most of the places or most of the companies that go on Shark Tank, you're a fledgling sort of mom and pop run out of your garage kind of small business, and the royalties, it's scary to you.
But the way he always demands to get his investment back, I find to be unnerving because he still gets the percentage of the company anyway. Why am I not hearing my mic very well?
Because the headphone, the fader was a little low.
All right. That's A. But I am on. This is not some joke where I'm talking and no one's listening. Well, people might hear. They might hear, but they're not listening. So that's my – now, who's the name of the QVC woman? What's her name?
Lori Grenier.
Lori's got one play. All right, here's the deal. I'm going to give you 7 seconds to decide. I'm going to give you $1 million. I want all of it. All of it right now.
Has done that before.
She does that a lot.
She tries to buy the product, which I'd be all in for.
Yeah, but that's not their dream.
But you know what everybody's dream is? Not working.
No, that's your dream. That's your dream.
Again, the people that say that they would still go to work if they had a gross amount of money, enough money to live high on the hog for the rest of their life, are liars.
What's the number?
They're liars.
You give me
enough money that you don't ever have to worry about
Give me
money.
That number.
$400 million.
Oh, well, $400 million is a ridiculous
Fine.
Amount of money.
$6 million.
You would stop working for $6 million.
Absolutely.
You're a loser.
Absolutely.
You are a loser.
Absolutely.
You don't deserve the air you breathe.
$6 million invested properly, easy. Never have to work again in your life.
That's fine. But would you have everything you ever wanted? $6 million?
I mean, define everything you ever wanted. I want a Gulfstream, so no, I'm not getting a plane.
It cuts into the
But I'll tell you
the,
what,
the
I'd have everything I'd ever need and some things I want.
Could you do – would you have a summer home with that, with $6 million?
Yeah. I mean, you can have it, you know – a mod, you know, you can have
a
very
house.
Nice summer home. You're not going to go live in a 15
kids in
bedroom
private
estate.
School? Kids in private schools?
No kids.
Oh, come on. All right. Well, now it's
what's the point of having money if I'm going to spend it on my kids?
You would stop working. Six is your number.
No, my number is actually lower than that. I've spoken about this with some financial people.
What's your number?
The number right now is 3.
You're pathetic.
Why? How is this not everyone's goal? Here's why it's everyone's goal. Why do people work? They work to one day retire.
No, they work.
They save for retirement.
Some people work for the satisfaction of doing something good.
No. No, they don't. That's why people volunteer.
When Gandhi was working, what was he?
You think Gandhi had a good 401k?
He was, I mean, you know, he's fully vested. They had great pensions. Great pensions. So, I mean, you know, the salaries, but you get it in the back of great benefits, good health care. Actually, ironically, for Gandhi, probably the health care was really an issue. But no, he will work. He will work for a lot of reasons. Psychologically, I mean, as a grown adult, you should be contributing to society.
You can still contribute to society without working. In fact, I would argue you can contribute more to society if you're unburdened from the shackles of work.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do to help society?
Whatever I want. I'll find a cause I'm passionate about. I'll get involved. I'll volunteer my time. I'll sit on some boards. It'll be great.
I'll sit in some boards. You know what they want? Your money.
Sure. And I've got some.
Not that much. Not with $3 million.
Enough. Again. We're not talking about how you can live this grandiose life. We're talking about how you can live without working.
So $3 million, you figure you're pulling in $1.50. On, you know, on your interest money, right?
Exactly, exactly.
You're going 5%? Is that what we're doing with this?
Yeah.
That's not enough. Forever? $1.50? I mean, $1.50 today is going to work. What about $1.50 10 years? But you're not going to live off the $1.50. You're going to put some of that back in.
Exactly.
You're going to live off $100.
It's the way it was described to me is it's, you know, a bulk of it in an account at 5%. You get some, like, some income properties and some real estate, that value. And then you have, obviously, the cash. Like, it's, you know, if you don't live, you know, this lavish lifestyle, you can actually hold on to just the cash for a while.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you want to – you don't want to go into the base. You don't want to.
No.
You got to – yeah, you got that – because, you know, here's the problem. You live longer than you thought you might, and then you have a real problem.
I do think this would be a good time to point out that neither Keyshaw nor I are certified financial planners, and you shouldn't necessarily take this advice.
That's important to note. It's important to note. You may use the advice, and it's free, but however, we don't want to be held accountable for any mistakes that you make based on our guidance. So you might want to seek, you know, paid professional counsel. We'd be happy to refer you to someone if you so desire.
Mike, what's your investment portfolio look like?
Oh, God.
It doesn't exist.
Shirt on his back.
Yeah. And that's all I got.
A couple of quarters under the mattress?
Maybe.
Well, it's a good time to start, though.
Piggy bank.
Start young. $3 million.
Three. That's a number. That's. I mean, it isn't my number, but it's my number that was given to me by a financial planner. He's like, this is probably the number. That's the absolute minimum number.
To retire.
Yeah.
At what age?
Now.
Right now?
Yeah, well, because of the investment, you know, the compounding, and it's almost irrelevant.
What if you're married? So for me, it's going to be like 6.
It would be different if you're married, of course. That's per person.
So because it's 6.
But, I mean, that said, not like 2 people or a family can live on $150,000 a year. That can absolutely happen. Now, not a 20-20 1% Keith Schroeder family.
Have you met my wife? that's her Stitch Fix, like, fee. I mean, Jesus. That's what we
said. I like how you're appalled at the thought of raising a family.
Well, I'm just how
on $150,000 a year.
Afford her mascara on that. I mean, Jesus. I mean, I got products in that bathroom that have products.
No, this is the activator for the other thing.
It takes her like 45 minutes to come to bed just because it's all this stuff going on. All in foreign languages. I can't even keep up. But sorry. So if I'm at 6, that's 300.
Right.
I mean, yes, obviously we should be able to do that.
Right. Again, this is your minimum number to live without working. This is not, you know, you get to live some lifestyles of the rich and famous life.
But I'm just worried at 300, what happens is then, like, that's great today, but, you know, 20 years from now, 300 is not 300.
Well, interest compounds. So what's 300?
Yeah, but I'm going to be spending most of that 300.
You don't have to.
I do have to.
But again, the way it's designed is that you don't put all your money in one account. You don't live off all the interest from all the money.
Right, you're saying I can't live off the 300 now. You're saying I have to put some of that back into equity.
You don't have to. Again, you could live. This is such a ridiculous discussion. I can only imagine what people are thinking out there when you're like, I can't do it. I can't live on $300,000 a year. It's not enough.
If we weren't the most offensive show on sports radio already, we have now crossed that divide. We have absolutely offended everyone. But I'm just thinking to myself, if I'm now, like, for life, what I mean, I'd like the $6 million, the $300 in interest off that, which I'm going to spend, which means there's no more money going back into the $6 million. So, again, my $300,000 today will not buy me what the same that it will 30 years from now. And if I don't add to the base, I'll still be getting the same $3
million. Right.
That's my point. So I can't live off $300,000. I actually have to live off $250,000. And now, so I can put $50,000 back. Is that right?
Can be.
Depends. That's what it comes
to. It depends
on
your investments. Are you going to get some income properties? Some real estate?
No, I don't buy. No, I'm not doing real estate.
They say that land is one of the best investments. Yeah. They're not making more of it.
Right. Well, that's great. That's what they told me in 2006 when I bought my house. All right. So the
not a great year to buy a house.
So when they draw that parabola, I'm the guy standing on the top of the flagpole. All right. I think the number's 10.
But you're basing that on a family of four.
Sure.
Okay. See, I'm going three on one person.
Right. So I go.
So 10. Our numbers are pretty similar.
I go 10 because that's a $500,000 a year, right?
Okay.
And then with that,
Mike Wallace literally can't fathom these numbers. He's like, I understand.
I'm just thinking about if I should hire you guys as financial planners.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You shouldn't.
No, that's a great idea. It's a great idea. So I go because then I get 500. I figure now that income gets taxed, obviously. But I take the 500, I live off maybe, because I want to live, because here's the problem. When you don't work, you spend more money.
That's probably correct.
You know what you do when you're not working? Online shopping.
Buy things. That is true. Exactly right. Yes, I agree.
So there are sales you never knew were happening. There's products you never knew. I mean, so I'd have all sorts of junk around my house. So I would probably want 500. I try to live off 400, put 100 in every year. Every 10 years, I'd have another million in that.
So there you go. Done and done. Should we tell the people what our big story is this morning?
Yeah, I'm pretty locked into this right now. Now I got that, and I want to see a great show. I just want to throw this out there. Went to go see Rhett Miller last night.
Yep, nobody knows who that is.
That's not true. And don't offend. He might be listening. He lives here in the Hudson Valley.
Rhett, I'm sure you're a great person.
No, he's...
You've overestimated your fame.
That's not... You are an awful person. Now
I'm sorry. I take that back. Keith Strudler has overestimated your fame.
The old 97s, please tweet at us at ESPN_classroom if you're a fan of the old 97s. And if you're not, just keep your pie holes shut. So
I will say we played their music last week. We played it during a commercial break. I like it. It's good music.
But he's a freaking rock star. He's a rock star. He's got long hair. He just looks the part. I got a little crush on him, as does my wife, apparently. So he's all that. Right? He's my age. He grew up in Texas like me. I want to spark a friendship. I really do. Married to a model. Like, he's a rock star. Married to a model. Record songs with Peter Buck of R.E.M. I told you before the show, he's friends with Julianna Margulies. He was at the final taping of The Good Wife. He was there in the room. Okay? I want to be friends with him. I want him to be my next famous friend. And I want him to do a song, the theme song for The Classroom.
Okay, that last part's good. Everything else you said, lie. First things first, first famous friend. Not next famous friend.
No,
first
Jack
famous
Ford
friend.
Ford and John Frankel.
Second point.
Whatever.
Second point. That rant was just you listing all the reasons he has no need to be friends with you.
He's got a mind. I could have stopped. You had me at he's got a model for a wife. Yep. So I just went. But it was so I saw that at the Town Crier last night at Beacon. Amazing show. Amazing. Really good. So that's that. And I wanted to throw that in there. If you're listening, Rhett Miller, ESPN underscore Classroom, buzz us. You know, maybe he's a listener. He's a sports fan. Maybe he's a listener.
Well, I do accept any new listeners. I love all our listeners.
Well, there's some listeners are more important than others.
Has this turned into Animal Farm? All pigs are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Well, the pig is the highest. Pig is the highest form in, you know.
In Animal Farm.
Yes, of course. Yeah. That's so. Pigs are. I mean, pigs are smart. They're very smart animals. Very smart animals.
I don't know, dolphins.
Yeah, but dolphins don't live in a farm.
True.
Pigs are very smart animals. You got a pig as a pet.
People do that now.
It's very she-she.
Yeah, like the little teacup pigs.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sure.
We got to take a break.
Yeah.
When we come back, our big story, Carmelo Anthony and a number of major NBA stars leading the charge for professional athletes to be more involved with political causes. Why now? Is this a good thing? What does the public think about it? Will it help or hurt these athletes' careers? That's what we're going to get into on the other side of this time out here in the classroom. Your weekly Smart Look at Sports is live on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. Check out The Classroom on Facebook, search for ESPN The Classroom, and follow us on Twitter at ESPN underscore classroom. We especially encourage Rhett Miller to follow us on Twitter.
He's getting a tweet right now.
That's personal service right there. A room service hop for Rhett Miller of, what's the band, the Old 97s?
Old 97s. That's his band, and he has some solo work, obviously.
How do we get him to record the theme song for The Classroom?
Well, first of all, you stop insulting him on the air, as you've done thus far. Let's start with that.
First of all, it's not an insult. It's not an insult. All right?
It's not an
insult. It's a recitation of fact. I think, if anything, he'll respect me for having the proper
view of his own celebrity.
If I know one thing about celebrities.
Okay, everyone, sit down. Buckle in. Uncle Jeff's going to tell you his view on celebrity life.
What do they always say? We're just regular people.
Well, they're not. No.
No. The best thing I've ever heard about celebrities came from Matt Damon. Big fan of Matt Damon. I like his movies. I like him personally in his interviews. Obviously, we've never met. Matt Damon says, celebrity doesn't change you. It changes everyone around you. And that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
I guess. I mean, that's fine. It's fine. I think it does change you. Because your number, like, by the way, I wonder what Rhett Miller's number is. I'm just curious. That's the first question we're going to ask. Rhett, how much is enough? How much money? I'd love to know what his number is. I'm going to tweet at him, and we'll see if we can get him on.
Do you want to make mention that archives of The Classroom are available on iTunes? Search for ESPN The Classroom.
Yep, and I've been really good about that. So we'd like to get those download numbers up. Another friend of the classroom I'd like to throw a little hello out to. Roan Apparel, doing very well.
Yes.
They are. We're going to get them back on. We'll get Nate Checkets back on the show sometime. We'll get some more gear is what we really need.
Check out roanapparel.com.
You know, let me also say, we'd love to be wearing some Roan Apparel when we head to the Iron Bowl.
Well, I think we'd look good at Bryant-Denny Stadium in some nice quarter zips. It's a chilly fall day, so you want to layer up.
You know what I'm thinking, actually? Now I'm really getting heady. We get that Roan Apparel, and we get a little monogram Center for Sports Communication on it.
Custom.
That's not – with our names, like their bowling shirts?
Or like a members-only jacket?
Yes. Yep. That's what I'm thinking. All right, you can take it. I'm tweeting right now.
While you finish your tweet, I will ask you about whether you saw something else on social media this week. Carmelo Anthony posted a very long – essentially call to action on Instagram telling his fellow professional athletes that silence is no longer an option and that it's incumbent on them to take a stand and try to effect change on social issues. I believe the inspiration behind Carmelo's post this week was the instances of violence against members of the black community from members of the law enforcement community. That's not to say that Carmelo has not been outspoken on other matters. He has made his viewpoints well known on race, gun violence, social justice, a whole host of issues. And this week, Melo again made it known that he is not shy about lending his voice to some of these very, very difficult issues in society. But I think he went further in asking others to step up and join the cause as well. And Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade, LeBron James seem to have answered the call as they opened the ESPYs by they asked ESPN for the time to speak on violence and race in society. This isn't a new thing. We've seen this before. Athletes have used their platform to, try to affect change before. But I feel like this is the most organized push that we've seen in a while. And I feel like it's also getting the most traction that we've seen in a while.
I'm still tweeting.
Yeah. You realize it's 140 characters. How are you still typing?
Well, so that's my problem. I want to go. I'm very loquacious.
Here's an idea. Why don't you tweet him during the next commercial break?
No, I'm almost done.
Well, we're going to sit silently until you finish.
I think he's getting nervous. He's trying to, find the perfect thing to say.
I do
get it. He keeps typing out messages, erasing it, typing out another one.
Delete. Why do you have the heart eyes emoji in there?
Because he has a crush on him.
It's true. I said I have a little.
It's a classroom romance.
It is. Hold on. I'm almost done.
It really is just 140 characters.
I know.
Do you want to read the tweet?
Yeah. Read it out loud. No. What do you have so far? What's your rough draft?
Spent part of show talking about Rhett Miller's awesome show in Beacon yesterday. Want him to come on the show. Can even talk Mavs and Rangers. See, that last part shows I know.
That he's from Dallas.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
Real aware.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
Nothing creepier than when a total stranger knows intimate personal details about you.
I'll get rid of about. That'll get me into my space here. Spark.
Keith Strudler just hocked a loogie on the microphone. He's getting so excited talking about Rhett Miller that fluids are starting to escape his body.
Spent part of show talking Rhett Miller's awesome show in Beacon yesterday. Want him to come on the show. Can even talk Mavs and Rangers. I think that deserves an exclamation point, maybe.
You still got a little something on your chin.
Take care of that. All right.
As Keith Strudler hits send, we'll actually talk about this morning's big story.
The big story.
Now I'm thinking I should have done it from my account so you could have seen what I look like. But that's weird. That's even weirder. This is getting really weird.
I should have just done it. So
really weird. We already got you on. What was the Tinder app we had?
Oh, Buddy. Buddy. We had Mike Wallace on Buddy, which is a Tinder style app.
Because that wasn't weird.
To find people that want to play sports together.
Yeah. So that didn't get weird at all either. So let's hit the big story.
Just let me know when you'd like to make a point about this new wave of activism that we're seeing among professional
athletes. So I'm ready to roll. All right. So I think. Going off of that, I think one of the other highly publicized events, and maybe not as publicized just because it's a lower profile sport, was the Minnesota Lynx. Several players from Lynx decided to wear shirts that had Black Lives Matter printed on them, as well as the names of the two African-American men who were killed this past week by police officers, as well as the logo of the Dallas Police Force. So they were paying homage to all of the very notable homicides in the past week, as well as kind of recognizing the Black Lives Matter movement. And at that game, as most of you know, off-duty police officers are often hired for security at sporting events.
Very, very common. Yeah. In fact, I'd venture to say they're probably at every major sporting event out there.
Seems like a good way to – they must work big hours, cops.
I have some friends that are police officers, and it's a good gig. You make a lot of extra money. It's a side. You're not paid by the state, by the police force, by whatever municipality you work.
Is it cash transaction?
No. It's like a freelance. It's basically like freelance police work that you're doing.
Yes.
But it's you get access to sporting events. I know a lot of them that have done it have gotten to meet some really cool people, and that's sort of part of the deal. So it's a pretty popular thing for police officers to do if they're trying to make some extra money.
These police officers, four who are working at the game. Actually walked off the job that night.
Yes.
Did not do their duty, didn't do their job. The police union, the head of the police union in Minneapolis, supported them and said, how dare the Lynx for doing that.
Conversely, I think it's an important distinction to make. They were not there as police officers. They were police officers, but working as themselves.
Yes, they were working at themselves, but I think with the understanding that they are hiring them, not just as bouncers, but because they are off-duty police officers.
Absolutely. But what it wasn't was a massive uniformed cops leaving a public situation.
And so the head of the police union supported them. However, the police chief of Minneapolis, as well as the mayor, expressed a lot of disappointment and was very critical, largely for saying that's not professional. And I got to tell you, I agree. I
see both sides of this. Because on one side, I believe that if you want to make a political stand, I think that's great. If you have the platform, I think you should do it. If you have the voice, you should use it. That doesn't mean that you're free from reactions to the stands that you take.
You're free from reactions, but when you're hired for a security job at an arena and you disband that job, you're putting people at risk. And you know what? I think that when you I understand you're not doing your duty as a police officer at that point, but you still are serving in the public interest. And when you walk off that job at that point, you are essentially putting people in harm's way.
This is why I see the other side of the issue, because police officers are the ones with training. They're the ones who sign up to protect and serve.
Yep.
And I think police officers will tell you this too. It's incumbent on them, because of the position they have in society and the training that they receive, it's incumbent on them to be the bigger person, the better person in situations like this.
And let's also – here's the other side of it. I understand that creates tension. The Black Lives Matter movement, particularly around some of these most recent shootings, creates a very – it feels adversarial. And when you have athletes who have a position of prominence and power that are promoting that ideology, I suppose, very publicly in an arena, I understand why police officers might feel that they are being marginalized, they're not being respected, and it's an unfair platform to take. So I get that, and I understand it gets confusing. I still think, like, I think a lot of this depends on your perspective of what America is like. I mean, this is what we're dealing with in this election. Your perspective on what's right and what's wrong has a lot to do with how you've grown up, the color of your skin, the experiences you've had. Let's be honest. We're on the radio. The three white guys sitting in a room right here from suburban, America. When we got pulled over by the cops, the first thing that probably came to most of our mind, of course, I've probably been pulled over than most of the rest of you guys, true story, but is that, what am I going to tell my dad? And I'm not saying that to be facetious or funny, but no, that's the reality.
I completely agree.
Right?
Completely
How am I going to explain this to my dad?
Yes.
All right? And so it's unfair for – I don't feel comfortable. It's not unfair. We can do whatever. I don't feel comfortable critiquing the Black Lives Matter agenda, because as even people on the right have said, several, Newt Gingrich amongst them, one of the few things he said that seemed to make sense to me, we don't understand, and so I'm not going to.
It's true, yeah. And
I will also say this, and I actually wrote about this week. There's a couple of reasons why I think athletes should be speaking out about this, and I think they do have to have sensitivity. I think one of the things that may have been problematic, at least from the perspective of the Minneapolis police officers, was that there wasn't a sensitivity to that.
But doesn't that sensitivity essentially dilute the activism? I mean, if you're going to answer the call and fight for something you believe in, to then immediately go and temper that to not hurt somebody's feelings.
I think it's fair to recognize that that the police have a very very difficult job.
Of course.
Horribly difficult
job. Anybody who does not recognize that fact, I don't care where you fall on this issue, anybody who doesn't recognize that is almost disqualified from being a part of the debate.
I mean, you go to work, we come home from work and we complain like, oh, my God, that guy was such a pain yet today. He complained, he sat in my office all day and just, you are at any point could get shot and killed. And you are going into awful situations. Even your non-dangerous days are rough. Like, they're all rough. So I am not going to in any way. So I guess the sensitivity has to come that, look, these people are important. They do the jobs that, I mean, they do things. They're like the military. They are the military. Yes. The reason we don't have military roaming the streets of this country on martial law is because we have cops that keep and maintain order, and that is very important. And even when they pull us over and they, you know, God, I really wish I shouldn't have gotten a ticket, that's how we maintain order in this country, right? And so I think there has to be a recognition that there are tons and tons of really good people who go into this. By the way,
absolutely right.
Of all races, color, I mean, you know, white cops, yeah. Black cops, Latino cops, it's everyone.
Any person. And we see this a lot, not just with police officers, but with people of certain religions, people of certain colors in this country. Anybody who paints a huge group of people based on the actions of a single or a very small amount of people is doing a significant disservice to any sort of positive discourse. So, I mean, that's just stupid.
So let's start with that, I think, as a recognition. And
the other side of the coin, though, police aren't infallible.
No. And
you know, the job is extraordinarily difficult and exceptionally vital.
But when you take the oath and you have the gun, you better realize the response. I mean, it's not something that should be taken lightly. This is a serious – it's kind of like being a doctor. Don't take that lightly. If you're going to cut someone's chest open, they're putting their life in your hands. Now, that said, I think one of the reasons, though, that athletes – should be speaking out, and I think they should speak out with a certain degree of sensitivity, and also they should speak out intelligently and with an informed kind of knowledge base. I think one of the things that becomes problematic when people just say things, the first thing comes to their head. I think people need to make intelligent. They have a huge platform. They need to use it wisely. Now, one of the reasons I think people suggest that athletes should be speaking out, particularly African-American athletes, is because they have a platform and they're role models. And that is all – that's all true. That's not – but athletes aren't the only ones who are in that position. Here's what I would say. I think one of the reasons that athletes should be speaking out is because they are some of the few people in America that from the moment they were – you know, they picked up a basketball or threw a football, they were almost by definition judged based on the color of their skin. Find me – we are all judgmental. What I wrote about was how my kids are playing summer league basketball down in Beacon now, which is great. My kids are two of maybe four or five out of 30 white kids in their summer league basketball. And, I mean, my kids don't care. I don't know if they notice. If they notice, they certainly don't care, which is the way it should be. But it's interesting the way everyone's judging the kids based on the color of their skin. My two kids were two of the last picked in the draft. Now, both my kids, I'm not just bragging because, you know, because obviously they come from great athletic genes, but they're pretty good. Like, my kids are – like, Sloan's pretty good. He's got a nice hand on the ball, dribbles with both hands, needs to work on his shooting. He's, you know
– I like it was at the level where dribbles with both hands is on the positive column of the scouting report. It's like, let me tell you about this kid. Uses the right and the left. You don't see that every day.
Remembers to go to the bathroom in between – in between quarters, we haven't had any wet problems. But so he's pretty good. Like, he's pretty good. And I watched the other kids play, and some are good, some are bad. And it's really not based on color. So my point is that, you know, athletes have gone through their entire lives being judged based on the color of their skin. If you are a football player, you're told what position you're going to play. I mean, there are people of a certain age who wanted to be quarterback. If you were, you know, of a certain age and you wanted to play quarterback – your entire life, even today to some extent, when you are African-American and you want to play quarterback, there is a certain perception of you as an athlete. So I think athletes have a very unique place and ability to speak intelligently about being judged on race. Now, that doesn't mean they know they aren't inherently informed about, you know, police violence and what's happening. And, you know, and a lot of athletes now, particularly athletes – if they are wealthy, are long removed from the communities that they are speaking about. Many of them may have come from those communities. They don't live there now.
That's actually a big point of what Carmelo Anthony said in sort of re-sparking this call to action was we need to be better about reinvesting in the places we come from.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, and Dave Zirin spoke about this a little bit, is what is the role of white athletes to speak about this? Yeah. And it's interesting and uncomfortable. And this is, you know, there are many, certainly in the NBA, predominantly African-American sport. You go into baseball, you go into football, there's a lot of white athletes. And what's the role of white athletes in speaking about that? With the Lynx, it wasn't just African-American athletes who were wearing those shirts. There were white players on the team.
And Dwayne Wade at the ESPYs, I believe it was Dwayne Wade, it might have been Chris Paul, acknowledged exactly that fact. He's like, these conversations are going to be uncomfortable, but we should have them anyway.
Yeah, I agree. And I think to some regard, athletes are very well positioned to do that. I hate to say it's their responsibility, but I think it probably is.
Now, you said that you only want athletes to speak out if they're informed and you feel like they have a grasp of the issues that they're speaking about. We live in a country right now where I don't know if we can agree on the basic facts about anything. For every person that has a statistic to support their point, someone on the other side has a statistic to support their point, and we have no, in my opinion anyway, agreement on what the facts are. How do you feel if a major prominent athlete stands up and uses his platform and his voice and the facts that he or she chooses to believe are the facts and takes a stand that is 100% opposite of your personal stand?
Sure, and we've talked about this a little before. It's problematic. We're about to see at the and a little tease for the next segment. We're about to see at the RNC at the convention, at the Republican National Convention, there are going to be some athletic figures who are going to get up. Not all the ones that we had hoped were going to get up, but we are going to see some athletic figures get up and say things that I very likely strongly disagree with. You know, it's human nature when someone speaks, you know, opposite of what you believe to be true, that it's harder for you to take. I guess if it's done the same way, respectfully and informed, I guess I don't have a problem with it. But that's the kind of dialogue that has to happen. But I will say that on both sides. And I think maybe this becomes part of the reason that the cops took umbrage in Minnesota. I don't think that they felt that protest or that voice was respectful, and whether or not and maybe they didn't feel it was informed, that's up to them. But I don't it really was just a shirt that they were wearing, although it did turn to a press conference which got fairly heated.
Well, you wear the shirt for a reason, so somebody asked you about the shirt.
Yes, like, you know. But it got pretty heated. But I think, look, when people start yelling things like we have to do something about, that doesn't help, which becomes a lot of the discourse. We have to do something about. What do we have to do? Like, what is that? You know, what is that? Yes, I think we all agree that no one likes people getting shot. And by the way, we all agree that we don't like people getting bombed in the streets. We all agree that we don't like terrorism, particularly, you know, and we've obviously dealing with extremist terrorism. We all agree on that. No one likes any of that. However, so we can all sit and yell, we have to do something about, but we don't all agree about how that is going to happen. And Donald Trump has a very different version of how that's going to happen than a lot of the rest of us, at least a lot of the rest of us sitting in this room. So maybe not the rest, maybe 40% of America maybe agrees with that.
We're living right now about 40-48. Gary Johnson, you might be getting in these debates. He might be getting in there.
Let's bring it. Let's make that happen.
I say let's bring him in. Let's bring Jill Stein in. Bring them all in. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, the more the merrier.
Let's go.
Remember when Gary Coleman was in a debate a long time ago? When they had to do a California special election.
Oh, I do remember that.
Oh, everyone
yes.
was running.
They had the recall. They recalled the governor. I do remember that. Everybody was running. And Arnold Schwarzenegger turned out to be the adult in the room. One more point before we go to break, because we got to go to break in a second, get to our next segment.
Oh, God.
Which you're going to want to absolutely stay tuned for. We've actually this week done some real journalism, and we're going to break some news in the next segment. Why now? Why now are we seeing athletes more inclined to use their voice and their platform where not too long ago Michael Jordan famously said Republicans buy sneakers too, and for why he plays it right down the middle.
I think athletes are more empowered than they've ever been before. I mean, the NBA athletes have certainly, I mean, you can just look at the way that they've negotiated their contracts. They make more money. They are going to play where they want with whom they want. I think there's a recognition by the athletes and also by the owners and management that this is no longer simply an owner's league. Now, I don't know if that's true in the NFL or in other, but I would say certainly in the NBA, athletes have really recognized the power that they have. I do think we live in a very confused age right now, but I do think, and the president said this on the air at the town hall, we're better than we were 40 years ago.
Oh, no doubt.
I mean, so
no doubt.
There's I think there's this feeling like, oh my God, it's 1964. It's actually not. We are better than we were a long time ago. And there are, and I don't know how to say this without sounding politically incorrect, 50 years ago, you wouldn't have scores and just, you know, flocks of white kids who idolize African-American figures.
No. Well, the president has said this too. If you were picking a time to live, you'd pick right now. Like, it's never been better than it – this is so easy to lose sight of.
Yeah.
It's never been better than it is right now. For all the problems still exist and all the work that still needs to be done, there's no time – these people that are like, I wish we'd go back to the good old days. The good old days –
they're not good.
Weren't good.
No.
And this is the best that it has ever been.
If you have kids, you recognize that because your kids see the world very differently than you do. And they do not – they really do not judge by race. And if you are able to kind of isolate them – and I think, to be honest, some of the hardest conversations, because my kids are huge sports fans, having the conversations about what they're watching on television and why some of the athletes are saying certain things, it gets you into deeper stuff.
And I think that's why a lot of people don't want athletes to speak out, because a lot of people look at sports as the other.
Yeah.
As I don't want to get involved in the presidential race and politics and terrorism and the issues of police and society. I want to watch a game.
A game
that has no impact on anything that matters. I want those guys to just shut up and throw the ball.
That's great. You know, we learned one thing from Muhammad Ali. That's just not the way it is. It's not the way it is. Not the way the world works. So I think I am encouraged by the voices that we hear. I'd like them to be respectful. I'd like them to be informed. But I think they are uniquely qualified. I think what we're also realizing, you know, it also helps us to get rid of the stereotype that these athletes can't be cerebral. And that's just, it's an important thing.
We got to take a break. We come back. Keith Strudler this week dug up the speech that Tim Tebow would have given at the Republican National Convention had he actually been invited or accepted that invitation. We did some journalism. We got a copy of his speech, and you're going to hear it next. More of the classroom ahead. Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. We in the classroom were really bummed this week. Really bummed that it turns out Tim Tebow, former national championship quarterback with the Florida Gators, little time in the NFL, commentator. We were really upset that he wasn't going to speak at the Republican National Convention.
I thought that was
a bread and butter watershed moment for this program, and it's not going to happen.
Yep.
However, Keith Strudler has found the speech that Tim Tebow would have given. He dug it up. This is a classroom exclusive.
You will hear this, I can promise you that, literally nowhere else.
Tim Tebow was to speak at the Republican National Convention. He is not.
Can we say this?
But if he did, this
is what he would have said.
This is what he would have said, playing the role of Tim Tebow, his fellow Florida Gator.
I might even say this is what we believe he would have said. This is what we believe.
For those of you like us, upset that you won't hear Tim Tebow speak at the Republican convention this week, this is what you're missing.
Yes. Do we have good definitions of what libel and slander is? No. All right. This is what we believe he would have said. Cue the music. Loud. First off, I'm really happy to be speaking to everyone here tonight, but I do have an admission. When my agent said I'd be speaking for Donald Trump, I assume he meant I was a contestant on The Celebrity Apprentice. So this is a bit of a surprise, which means I'm going to have to scratch my remarks about Gilbert Gottfried being an awful project manager, or how I was going to throw Little John under the bus. Just a communication snafu. Anywho, so it seems I'm here to offer my endorsement for the next president of the United States, Donald Trump. Now, again, fictional, I'm playing Tim Tebow here. Now, I'm sure you have a few questions for me. Like, why would I endorse someone who's made racist comments? And what do I know about politics anyway? Or, why couldn't I learn to throw a spiral after like 20 years of playing football? Those are all good questions, but I'm not going to answer them. I'm guessing the other question you all really have about this endorsement is this. Tim Tebow, and yes, I refer to myself in the third person always. Tim, what would Jesus do? And really, how the hell am I supposed to know what Jesus would do? If it's so important, ask the Pope yourself. So, the other question you have, why would a man like myself associate with a man like Donald Trump? Someone who encourages violence, someone who may have knowingly caused harm to other humans. And I say this, I played football with Aaron Hernandez, willingly. So I made that deal with the devil a long time ago. No point in crying over spilt milk today. I say when in Rome, for whatever that means. See, the way I look at it, being president is a lot like being quarterback. You get way too much credit when things are good, way too much blame when they're bad, and you never get a fair shake if you're black. Which makes me uniquely qualified to weigh in on the presidential contest. See, Donald Trump is going to be great for America. Just like I was great for the New York Jets. See, if you say it out loud enough times, it almost becomes believable. And there's a whole lot of things I like about Donald Trump's policies. Take, for example, keeping immigrants out of this country. I totally agree. It's time we preserve American jobs for Americans. Like, for example, in the National Football League. We need to make sure that more Americans, like Tim Tebow, for example, have a job in the NFL. Those jobs shouldn't go to foreigners or people who can throw 30 yards downfield or even people who don't spend their entire off seasons making short autobiographical films and doing photo shoots for underwear commercials. We need to keep NFL quarterback jobs safe for real Americans like Tim Tebow. So put that wall up around Jacksonville and Kansas City and Cleveland, although I'd really rather not play there. And you know who's going to pay for it? That's right, Mexico, where I've done 7 of my 30 missions during high school and converted at least 100 people. Even Tim Tebow's got to make his numbers. So at the very least, Mexico, you owe me this. I could go on and on about Donald Trump and his economic genius, his fabulous hotels, and even his luxury line of ties that are at least an inch too wide by modern standards. And I'm being generous. But I'd be remiss in not addressing one of the real reasons I'm standing here in front of you all, the Republican National Convention, an audience that makes an afternoon at the DMV feel like a trip to Studio 54. See, as you know, I have pledged my celibacy to the world, remaining pure until the day that I get married. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing, but that's neither here nor there. This celibacy pledge was something I said a long time ago. I mean, long before I had a lot of options, so it didn't really matter then. But then came the whole Gator thing and the Heisman, and let's all say we say things we wish we hadn't had, we never had said. But now that's like, sorry, but now that's like my thing. I mean, like Pitbull's got tight pants, Dikembe Mutombo got the whole finger wag thing, and I've got this albatross. But whatever, a promise is a promise, right? So I have to basically take this one day at a time, one temptation at a time. And I figure there's literally no place in the world that would offer less temptation than the Republican National Convention. I mean, listening to this crowd talk about the great state of whatever, it is a serious buzzkill. It's like jumping into a giant tub of ice water, if you know what I mean. I honestly think that Brett Baer's voice should be used to help prevent pregnancy in teenagers. It's at least worth thinking about. So whatever or not Donald Trump wins the election, doesn't win the election, who really cares? For me, it's just one day at a time. One day at a time. That's all I've got for you tonight. I'm on my way to CFL minicamp, assuming I'm allowed to work outside of the U.S. And then off to film an action movie with my co-star Joel Alstein. It's really a love story. And God bless these United States of America, and God bless Tim Tebow. Very mediocre read on my part. Reading's not my strength. So that's what Tim Tebow would have said. Tim Tebow, ladies and gentlemen. Yep, that's what Tim Tebow would have said if he were speaking on the fourth night. And I think, by the way, he would have pulled in some votes with that.
I think Brett Baer's voice should be used to prevent teen pregnancy.
It's a thought, America. It's just a thought. I'll tell you what. You play that right after the high school prom. I got to tell you, I do believe that Tim Tebow went all celibate. I don't want to get too deep here. You know, at one point, and then all of a sudden, next thing you know, he's winning the Heisman Trophy. He's like, oh, boy.
His mouth wrote a check. And all of a sudden,
he got real on that.
So, we got to take a break.
Yeah.
Another hour of this ahead. No more Tim Tebow. That's all the Tim Tebow we got for you. But coming up, we're going to talk about the sale of the UFC. Keith Strohler's going to try to convince me to watch the Tour de France. It's not going to work. We'll also have some grades of the week and a lot more fun. Another hour of the classroom is ahead. Your weekly Smart Look at Sports continues next on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. This is the second hour of the classroom. I'm Jeff Peralta. He's Dr. Keith Strohler, director of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication. Mike Wallace is hanging out as well, making sure this program sounds good to everybody out there in the Hudson Valley. Boy, how about that Tim Tebow speech? I'm glad that you got to hear it here, because you will not hear it next week in Cleveland. Tim Tebow's not going to speak, and I think that's a shame, because I think he wrote a pretty good speech.
Yeah, well, and I think his delivery would have been very strong, because he probably would have read it once before he wrote it. I mean, he would have read it in private before he read it out loud. But, I think that would have killed. I think it would have killed, and it's unfortunate. Now, is Bobby Knight speaking, or is he not speaking?
No, I don't think so.
Ditka?
No. I actually don't think. I mean, they haven't released the list. Then they release this list of Tim Tebow's on, and then Tim Tebow's like, "I'm not speaking." So I don't think anybody knows.
Just like
a lot of people think nobody's speaking. A lot of people think it's just going to be Trump's kids.
What if I told you that Rhett Miller was speaking?
Oh man, I don't think so. I don't think that would actually really hurt my bromance potential, because I don't think I could handle that. Well, how about this? You can't do it. I mean, let's say you are Rhett Miller, and this is a chance you're getting a million. You don't play. You don't play at the RNC.
I mean, I can't. I don't know his politics.
I think he probably can figure it out.
But I mean, a very common thing is musicians, artists will tell political campaigns they don't agree with that, no, you can't play my stuff.
Yes, that's right.
That happens all the time.
Yes. So no one's going to be speaking, don't we? I thought we had a lineup.
Well, we did. It was released, but then now all the people that were on are like, oh, I'm not doing that.
Tyson? Is Tyson?
I don't know. I don't think he was ever on. I mean, I would have loved to have seen it. I still would.
It's going to just be a crazy land.
It was, I mean, the list that was released was basically all members of Trump's family.
Yes.
Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
The ex-military general Michael Flynn.
Yeah.
The guy who was going to, you know, whoever the vice president was going to be now, you know, it's going to be Mike Pence.
So he's going to have a lot. He's going to have a lot of room to speak. He can speak as long as he wants. Mike, you could go for an hour, just stretch. These are long days too. Like, these conventions are long.
Long. 4 days all day, and then we see like an hour every night.
Yeah, but it's all. I mean, there's a lot of.
Although the Republican one might be a little shorter, because apparently no one's going. Like, no governors are going. No senators are going. I don't know who's going to be in this place. Like, who's going to be there?
Classroom should be live from the Republican National Convention.
I'll go to Cleveland. Sneakily good restaurants in Cleveland.
Yeah, I don't like Cleveland, though.
Nobody likes Cleveland.
No, I don't like it.
That's why I'm trying to get you there with like surprisingly good restaurants.
Really?
Well, great chef Michael Simon is from Cleveland,
so he's opened
like seven restaurants in Cleveland, and they're all really good.
His town.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, you went to a nice restaurant this week, you said.
In Beacon, yes.
Yeah, you went to Cafe Almacourt.
I did. It was very good. Very good.
You liked it.
I did. Yeah. I did. I had a short rib pasta. I liked it very much. Mm. You know, you can buy a lot of short rib pasta now. Dana White.
Sure.
UFC this week sold for...
Dana White hit, for those of you listening, he hit his number.
Yes. and a couple times over. UFC sold for $4 billion to WMEIMG. $4 billion. Put this in context of some recent major sports transactions. The Los Angeles Clippers famously went to former Microsoft exec Steve Ballmer for $2 billion.
That's just one team,
of course. One
team. Yes.
One team. Now, the UFC is a lot different than a team in that it's everything.
Yes.
It's all the fighters. It's everything.
You get the whole kit and caboodle.
$4 billion.
It's a lot.
For a sport that basically didn't exist a decade ago.
Yep. And one that has all sorts of liabilities wrapped around it. Now, it's a global property, so that's something. But it seems like it's one horrible death away from being really problematic, and one that relies on state legislatures to ensure its ability to continue.
I do always wonder, whenever somebody sells something that's at its pinnacle, like why did this sale happen now?
Yes. It's when AOL goes for sale. Yeah, I think we just want to get out. We want to diversify. We want to try some new things. Exactly. Companies that are on the rise. There's a reason why, you know, years ago Facebook decided not to sell, right? Because they realized they had a rising property. So it does suggest, you know, this is why BlackBerry said, yeah, I think we'll let the technology go. We can do that. So obviously, yeah, I think it was time for UFC to get out because I think it's a high risk. I don't want to say low reward, but I don't think there's a ton of reward for UFC because I don't personally see endless growth for this property. I think there's a vast percentage of America, and again, they're banking on the world, not America, but I think certainly in America, there's a lot of people that will never watch it. I think it almost exclusively stays in the niche space. Now, perhaps they think in a cut-the-cord landscape, pay-per-view properties become very appealing, and that's where they'll make their money is off pay-per-view potentially. So maybe they're looking at this from purely kind of an economic model perspective. But I really do think there could be a recoil at some point where whether it's governments say we're not going to do this, it's too brutish, or you have death. I'm shocked that we haven't had a very high-profile death in the ring. I really am, and maybe I just don't know the sport well enough.
What the future holds for the UFC obviously remains to be seen. What we know now is that at a $4 billion valuation, the sale of the UFC is the most expensive transaction for an organization in the history of sports. It has greatly changed the economics of the value of these sports properties. And to help us learn more about exactly what that might mean for not just the UFC, but for sports in general, we're happy to welcome to the classroom one of our favorite guests, Rob Boland, director of the Masters of Sports Administration program at Ohio University, formerly spent a lot of time right down the river at NYU. Rob Boland, thanks for coming into the classroom this morning.
Thanks, guys. A pleasure to be with you this morning.
This huge number surrounding the UFC sale, $4 billion. What does that do for the economy of sports properties, whether it's an NBA team or a fledgling league like professional women's soccer? I mean, what does this do for the market of sports properties in not just America, I guess, but the world?
Well, it certainly has ballooned them for the moment. The question will be, is this a property that will be a benchmark sale, or it will be an outlier for going forward? And I think we won't know about that for maybe, you know, the next year to 2 years as to we look into the cycle of, and see how this works and whether this gain has been recouped. If you think about it, the $4 billion price tag came after a couple of Chinese capital firms had bid on it and then was bought by William Morris Endeavor / IMG. As a property, an American-based firm, and Silver Lake Capital is a big investor, but it's 20 times earnings. So it's a pretty significant bubble to think about, much greater to some degree than an NBA team or something else. So it remains to be seen if this is going to be an outlier or this is going to be a pretty good deal.
Yeah, Mr. Wonderful.
That's a shark.
Kevin O'Leary's not making that deal.
No way.
Rob, Dr. Stroll and I were talking about this a second ago. Why did the sale happen now? Because up until about a week before, Dana White was denying that the UFC was for sale, even though I think everybody knew that it clearly was.
I think if you think about it in the life cycle, though, that the Fertitta brothers and Dana White needed to cash out of this. They certainly weren't having to have telethons or radiothons in their honor because they were poor and losing money, but they weren't able to create an equity situation by which they got wealth from this that was generational. This was their opportunity to become that, and to a degree to stay with the firm to some managerial capacity. So it just made sense that they do this. They had grown the sport. It was in its life cycle that it should transact, and it did. This was their opportunity. The other way you think about companies that do this, it would be the same thing as taking a company that had been very successful privately, taking it public to recoup that wealth for the shareholders and the developers.
Do you think that there's continued growth opportunities for UFC? My thesis is that this sport has almost an inherent cap on what it can do. And I actually think that there's at least as good a chance that it will kind of recede as it will grow. And maybe I'm thinking this almost far too much from an American perspective. And am I underselling UFC as a sports property, or do you think that there's this kind of growth potential?
I think your doubt is well placed. I don't think it's I don't necessarily disagree that it's it may be close to its U.S. ceiling. I think the real value of it was its global distribution possibility. I think that was the thing that was interesting the firms in Asia. I think that's where they think growth opportunities come, particularly on a global scale, particularly when you think about that you really can't recreate the NBA in India or China, but wherever the UFC goes around the world, it just sort of pops up and takes place without a great deal of investment and opportunity and pain. So I think it's a very portable property. It could have multiple platforms going simultaneously, and it's the best known. So I do think of that. On the other hand, if I were buying it, I'd be concerned that, as you mentioned, it's a highly regulable property. So it requires a lot of – it has a lot of state insurance issues here in the United States. It could be one that is that's limited. And then the other thing I think about, and the benchmark I'd use to describe this is a Chinese investment firm, Dalian, bought Iron Man about a year ago in September for about $600 million. Iron Man arguably had better intellectual property than the UFC does, that in the sense that the Iron Man image, likeness, trademark, the distances that they competed at were unique and special. UFC's in my mind is one very successfully marketed form of mixed martial art, and I'm not sure you get a whole lot with it in terms of that. There are other workouts, it's diversified, there are some trademarks and patents held, but very little that's irreplaceable.
Yeah, I agree on, I mean, being a triathlete myself, Ironman has a very special place and is a ubiquitous. I mean, Ironman means something. We have watches, people get tattoos. It does mean something. Well, how do athletes fit into all of this? Because we talked about, look, that you're buying the whole thing. Is there a chance that athletes might get up and say, look, we want a bigger piece of the pie. We're gonna, you know, do something that might really infringe upon the ability for UFC to make the kind of money they want. We don't talk a lot about the athletes' place in this.
Well, I think it's the athletes to some degree that have fueled the rise in mixed martial arts, and not because they're special or extraordinary, but because they work cheap. One of the things that really sort of allowed boxing to decline and mixed martial arts to rise, in part, was the participation, the widespread participation, the relative higher level of safety, but the fact that the great boxers knew they were valuable and their promoters basically pulled the market in for an arm and a leg, where mixed martial arts athletes were competing for very modest prize money and weren't really exclusive. They could compete where they wanted, when they wanted. It was the UFC that offered the best purses and the best matches and had promoted the people to the highest level. So a Ronda Rousey or someone like that was a UFC creation to some degree. I think the athletes are entirely fluid. And if you want to think of it this way, I guess the two analogies I'd bring is when you bought the LA Clippers, you had to pay some players a lot of money, but they were exclusive. They couldn't play for anybody else until the Clippers decided either to not re-sign them or trade them. So you had some fixed and tangible assets in athletes there, not that they're ever really fixed, but you had assets under contract. In the same way you think about it like professional wrestling going back a decade or more, when there were the pro wrestling wars of Ted Turner and Vince McMahon having separate cycles and fighting over the talent and the personalities, they were at least under contract and their names were owned by one of the agencies or the other. None of that is true here. The athletes are absolutely mobile, and to some degree, the success of the sport, what made it so profitable, is that the athletes worked very inexpensively. They weren't unionized. They were easy and they were replaceable. And to some degree, that's what would make me worry about this, is somebody else just has to go get compelling athletes and create compelling conversation to be competitive. On the other hand, The UFC does have the best distribution network, and that was the thing that made them powerful.
We're talking with Rob Bolin of Ohio University. To underscore those numbers, the most that a UFC fighter has ever been paid just happened last weekend. Brock Lesnar got $2.5 million. That is the most that a UFC fighter has ever been paid.
$2.5 million,
exactly.
Yeah.
A relative pittance compared to the $50, $60, $70 million a night that Floyd Mayweather would make for a boxing fight. For a defensive boxing fight with no action. Brock Lesnar goes and essentially puts his life on the line for $2.5 million. So, Rob, now that the market has been set, the UFC is worth $4 billion. As it stands right now, you just mentioned this, not a lot of competition. I mean, there's a couple other outfits out there, Bellator, K1, like they exist, but some people may have just heard those names for the very first time. Now that this market has been set at $4 billion for the UFC, is this not going to give rise to a well-funded competitor who's willing to offer fighters $4 million a fight to go fight under their promotion?
It certainly would make some sense if rather than try to buy an entity like this or buy a competitive entity, why don't I just enter this space? In fact, if you're somebody like me who's looked at the history of the major sporting firms over the years, whether it's agent firms, whether it's promotion firms, I always sort of scratch my head and sort of say, why did I buy that? Why did I buy that business? Why didn't they just start to compete? And to some degree, that's always been, if you think historically for the 50 or so years IMG has been in business, that's always been a question mark. Do you actually go in with them? Do they buy you, or do you compete with them? And I think you can see success on both platforms. But yes, there's nothing exclusive. There's nothing that prevents competition. The advantage that William Morris and Endeavor and IMG have is this is a property with global reach, and they have sort of the unmatched distribution capability. And I think the other thing they have is because mixed martial arts has been interesting as a property in kind of crossover entertainment, I think they see this as valuable that Ronda Rousey can be in action movies, and which are also WME products. So I think they see synergies here that they're hoping will be produced. Not sure that they necessarily exist at the moment, and I think they do see the opportunity to negotiate new deals. But on the other hand, if I had a really attractive, interesting personality who could create a great deal of interest, I'm not sure that the format is as important as the personality.
Yeah, I'm thinking kids cartoons, breakfast cereals, bed sheets, the whole deal. What would a high profile death do to this sport? That's always been my thought. What happens when they have the nuclear option?
It would be devastating, I would suspect. I'm not sure NASCAR has fully ever recovered from Dale Earnhardt's death, and to some degree, the great success of NASCAR was that its star athletes didn't die by and large. They had crashes, but they mostly walked away from them, and that's a sport without a combat element. Boxing has been very fortunate not to have had an enormously high-profile death of a star or a star competitor, at least until years after, and it suffered a decline because of the violence and the degradation it takes on people's bodies. Football's been lucky that while it has had deaths, it doesn't seem to affect the cultural fiber, although it's under some fray. I think mixed martial arts is, if you were to think of it this way, Its cultural connection is not a very strong piece of cable. It's much more of a rope, and I think it would cut very quickly. I think people would maybe move out of it. It also, again, would put the UFC brand and almost all the assets that it has, whether it's the octagon, whether it's some of the trademark catchphrases, whether it's the whole broadcast idea, it would make it vulnerable, too, to either a safer alternative, a more humane alternative, something that was interesting but not it. And I think that's where I would be very concerned about this purchase and what did I get in terms of intellectual property value and places where competitors can't take advantage, paying 20 times EBITDA for it.
You know, in considering things that might make the UFC less popular, I wonder if the sale itself might do that. I mean, this is a sport that essentially rose to prominence as counterculture and underground, and it was gritty. And now, I mean, at $4 billion and with the William Morris agency attached,
well,
I mean,
like the X
this
Games
is
dilemma,
this is as
right?
mainstream as yeah. mainstream can be now. Is it going to lose some of its edge?
That's difficult to say, and maybe not a question that anyone can really answer. I think it probably does lose its gritty edge. On the other hand, does its distribution just make it that much more exponentially popular out of doing it? Certainly, William Morris and IMD are banking very heavy on the latter being true. The sport has had some different moments in its own development, so it's an interesting question that I don't know if anybody can really answer. But it certainly probably is true that the thing you'd worry about anytime you have a highly entrepreneurial environment, Dana White is very much synonymous with the sport. The Fertitta brothers are very much synonymous with the sport, and you wonder now, having a kind of a mainstream corporate culture now attached to it, will this cause them to drift away from it? Will having been paid cause them to ratchet back their role, their innovation, their belief in it? So, and I think that's probably the bigger one that you'll see, is that the managerial and entrepreneurial culture will change around the sport. And that may have more profound effects in the short run.
Yeah, you're worried that it's going to be the I only listen to old REM albums, right? Yeah, we're going to have that problem. So we have two questions, neither of them particularly serious, but very important. First, do you know Rhett Miller and the old 97s?
No, I don't.
No, okay. No surprise there.
Oh, stop it. Stop it.
Nobody knows Rhett Miller and the old 97s.
Stop it. You're going to make it so he'll never talk to us. Rhett Miller is the lead singer of the old 97s, one of my favorite bands. Saw him play last night at the town
crier. Could also be the name of Keith Strudler's postman, and the old 97s could be a brand of small batch whiskey that's brewed in the Hudson Valley. No one knows.
Actually, as a Hudson Valley native, I think that would be – I think the small batch whiskey idea is an excellent one.
Well, they do it now in Beacon. There's
actually a lot of that. Rob, are you a Hudson Valley native?
Yeah, he's Orange County.
I grew up on the Orange County side of that.
I didn't know
Valley.
That. Yeah, yeah, we got a lot of distilleries now. Denning's Point,
right.
Puddletown.
Yeah, that's great.
A lot of good ones. Dutch Spirits, great artisanal moonshine.
You are going to ruin any chance we have of having Rhett Miller create a theme song for us, all right? He's – hangs out with Juliana Margulies. What else do you need? All right, so that's A. B.
That's really all you need, right?
That's exactly. B, and this is something that we started the program talking about. What is your number? And I say we are trying to decide how much money.
You do realize what is your number has a totally different societal context than what we're talking about.
It
refers to the number of people that you have been with. That's when somebody asks you what is your number. That's your number.
Well,
that's a much lower number than the number I used to associate with myself, which is my old football number.
So we're gonna try this again and let Keith Strudler set up our question of the day in a slightly different manner.
Put me down for 74. That was the number I wore very ignominiously for the Columbia Lions.
That's a good number.
Yeah, I wish, right?
Well, I don't know. We've decided, how much money does it take for you to walk away and never work again? Jeff set his number, I think, unreasonably low. I, on the other hand, like to live high on the horse and also see value in working. You know, Jeff sees work as...
I see value in a 9 a.m. tea time 5 days a week.
Jeff works to live, and I, you know... I'm a more balanced. I like to contribute.
You work to complain about work.
True. I work because my wife won't let me stay at home. So what is the amount of money that someone would have to write a check to you right now to walk away?
It's unfortunately very big because I'm a lawyer with bourgeois taste.
Nah.
But it's about $10 million.
Oh, that was my number.
that was key. Now, see, I base my number on single, no children,
sure,
live the life of leisure.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you have kids, family, you need a little more.
Yeah.
I'm told kids are expensive.
They can be.
But if you're coming back to the original story, Dana White has that now.
Yes.
Yes. That's actually the way we intro the segment. He doesn't have to worry about where the next meal's coming from.
I will
now.
Say
$400 million.
I'm guessing your number, whatever it is now, is probably a little lower now that you're out in Ohio than it was in Midtown.
Well, I'm talking to you from Manhattan this morning, so every time you come here, it's like I spend more in a week in Manhattan than I do in a month in Ohio. So.
You spend more in a lunch in Manhattan.
Yeah, that's true, too. All right, well, that's good. That was important. I'm comfortable with that number.
Rob Boland, director of the Master of Sports Administration program at Ohio University, and a Hudson Valley native,
yes,
is our guest of the classroom this morning. Thanks so much for coming back on.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you again.
Do you think, because I know you're not a big UFC guy.
Nope.
I've never really been, but I find that I'm sort of coming around. I find I'm finding myself more interested in it as it gets more popular.
Why?
Because I think it's bandwagon. I think it's compelling. It's I think they've created some compelling storylines.
But it's brutal.
I agree. It's brutal.
So I mean, so just because it's a spectacle, it's a bigger spectacle, doesn't mean, you know, if more people are doing something that's awful, doesn't make it better or more people are watching it. It's more reason that we should ban it. It's to be honest, when it's just a small group of people that are doing harm to themselves that not a lot of people are paying attention to, at all, I almost don't care. The reality is I don't want this being a mainstream, highly watched, normalized sport in America. I don't want kids growing up thinking this is okay. Like, it's bad enough. Wrestling, everyone kind of understands it's fake. So kids grow up watching
professional wrestling, WWE.
Yeah. Your kids watch it. And they, you know, you're like, maybe my kid shouldn't be watching this. But everyone kind of understands it's fake and it's not a big deal. I still don't like it. This isn't fake, though. I don't want kids watching this and thinking this is normal human behavior.
So boxing's okay? Should boxing be banned?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know that – I don't like boxing that much. I understand and I know a lot of people who really appreciate boxing. And really think it's a science and it's an art form and all that.
You can make the same argument about mixed martial arts as well.
I can't because it's
– Well, people that make that argument about boxing would also make it about mixed martial
arts. I don't
know
if they would. It is far more brutal. It is.
I don't disagree with that, but that doesn't take away from the tactical element of being in a fight.
Sure. You could also give people guns and put them in a room with barricades and say it's still tactical, right? But that doesn't mean that we should be watching it. So I think there's something – if we are going to recognize that sport is almost inherently violent, so it's not whether it's violent or whether it's not violent. It's how violent. There will be shades of gray, right? And that's – we have to recognize that. And so I'm not so sure – I'm not defending boxing. And I could easily be okay with them saying boxing is no longer legal, and I would understand that. I do think that UFC is further along that spectrum. I could also understand them saying, you know what, we're going to allow boxing with more regulations, more testing for concussions, but we're not going to allow UFC. Because it's just too brutal.
From a legislative standpoint, I believe the UFC is now legal in all 50 states. I think New York was the last holdout, and I believe just recently New York said they will now sanction –
Sure.
Mixed martial arts fights.
Horse racing, casinos, and mixed martial arts.
Which I believe is a pretty big deal for the sport. I don't know this, so I ask this not knowing whether it's true or not. That's why I'm asking it as a question, I suppose. I'm curious if you know, is the UFC more dangerous than the NFL?
I don't know. It's a great question. I mean, I think there's two questions. One is whether it's more dangerous for the participants. And two, and obviously, we don't have data, so it's not like – It's not like we know.
Right.
Secondly is whether it's more dangerous as a spectator commodity. So what does it do to the public that watches it? You know, I think the NFL, if it's played correctly and if they create rules that you know, at least make it less brutish or brutal, I don't think people watch the NFL thinking the goal is to incapacitate and hurt someone else. I think when you watch – I mean, the goal in the NFL.
I think if you ask some NFL strong safeties, you might get a different answer.
That's fine, but I'm saying when my kids watch the NFL and they don't watch it thinking I'm watching it so someone can knock someone else out. They watch it because they want to see football and they like to see guys score touchdowns and throw passes and they love the quarterbacks, right? And they love the statistics. People watch the UFC. People watch UFC and mixed martial arts so they can watch people knock other people out. That's very different. So whether or not it's more or less dangerous to the participants, that's one thing. Now, there's going to be a lot more football players. I mean, they don't have to do mixed martial arts in high schools. So you're going to have a lot more people that are going to be impacted by football. So, yeah, I'm guessing it's more dangerous to the football participants because there's just a lot more who do it. But that doesn't – I don't think that should be the determinant. And I do think, you know, I mean, what's next? I say this half facetiously, is next that we get let people have guns and we let them shoot each other as long as they don't kill each other? I mean, what becomes next?
I mean, competitive paintball's been around for a while.
Yeah, so, I mean, but what is next? Like, what is next, right? You give people kind of bulletproof vests and machine guns and let them go at each. I mean, really, what's next? So I don't think just because it's strategic or because, you know, it's a sport makes it something that we should do. And getting back to that, maybe I'm overestimating the public, which is always a dangerous thing to do. I do think that this does have still limited and somewhat niche appeal. Michael Wallace has taken little interest in this conversation.
$4 billion might tell you otherwise. Michael Wallace, UFC fan?
A little bit. Yeah. Just the big name fights.
Yeah, that's kind of how I am too. But I mean, I've never like bought a pay-per-view or anything. But no. I find myself interested more in the results and in the matchups and in the characters.
Do you enjoy watching it though? I find it.
I mean, I'll be honest. I haven't watched much of it. But I just find like I find myself as time goes on significantly more intrigued by it than in the past when it was an afterthought to me.
I find it to be more disturbing. I don't like to watch it. I find it disturbing.
There's definitely something primal about it. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, that is the appeal. That is the appeal.
Let me just lay this out there. Not a very primal room.
No. My God, no. But I also think
there's not a lot of manhood in this room.
But I also think that's part of the appeal of it as well.
You're a tough guy? Pants.
No, I'm not I am wearing – we've had this
You're
conversation.
You're not wearing pants.
I'm wearing pants.
No.
I'm wearing biking pants.
Those aren't pants.
Biking
Those
shorts.
You were wearing underwear.
Biking. So is everyone in the Tour de France, which we're about to go into, are they all wearing underwear?
Yes.
That's ridiculous. That's just stupid.
To be fair, the people in the UFC, they basically compete in their underwear.
Oh, you know, you don't call them out on it.
I sure do.
That's fine.
I mean, I'm not to their face, to be fair, but
hey, panty waist. we have to take a break.
We do. When we come back, Keith Struthers is going to try to convince me to like the Tour de France. It's not going to work. More of the classroom ahead. Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. Welcome back to the classroom. Find us on Facebook, ESPN The Classroom. Like us on Twitter at ESPN_classroom. I'm Jeff. He's Keith. Mike Wallace hanging out. We've reached the part of the show where Keith Struthers tries to convince me that the things that he likes are great, and then I bring him back to reality and tell them they're not. We spent that entire commercial break fighting about the old 97s.
He was on 30 Rock.
Was it really?
Yes. Yes.
And still no one knows.
I mean, you're missing, like,
here's, none of us are arguing that they're not a successful band. None of us are arguing that they're not good. They're not what you think they are. They're not part of the public consciousness. They're not popular.
No, but yeah,
they don't have a Q score. They're a good band that you like.
Here's what you don't get. Here's what this is what you're missing. So there are people that, even though they don't necessarily have enormous mainstream appeal, I mean, they have, you know, some mainstream appeal, but they are so highly respected within the industry that they're just bigger. They're outside.
That doesn't make them famous.
Oh, it makes them, but it makes them bigger than what you suggest they are. Like, they are big within the musical community. Like, they are
That's not what we're talking about. You're talking about them, that there are random people on the street who are immediately going to recognize this band or this person, and that it's sacrilege for someone not to have heard of them. And I'm telling you, it's commonplace for people not to have heard of them.
I will. I will read a line from their Wikipedia page that actually, I shouldn't do this, it actually speaks to your point. The band has never reached the level of success expected of them by the music press. Loved by the music press. And was one of the acts purged from Elektra after the merger of Time Warner and American Online. Conversely, though, in 2005, Blender magazine ranked the band's most successful single, 1999's Murder or Heart Attack, as the 176th greatest song since you were born.
That's a deep list. That's a deep list.
You know how many songs?
I tell you what, I want to hear the debate about 176 or 175. You talk about an esoteric topic.
Do you not
topic.
Understand how many songs come out?
I am not saying that they're not a good band.
Our show couldn't rate any episode of this show we do could not make the 176 best shows that's produced in the Hudson Valley each week.
I don't know. Remember we mad-libbed Kobe Bryant's retirement letter? That was pretty good.
That was pretty good.
No one is arguing that they're not a good band. No one's making that argument. No one's arguing they don't have fans. We're arguing their popularity and their celebrity. You say they have some. The rest of the world disagrees.
I'm looking at some other things that they've done. They have a tribute band.
Okay. What? I tell you what, that is a tribute band that maybe should.
It's really a niche.
That's a niche tribute right there.
I'm just trying. I'm looking for more here.
You might be starting to learn, good people of the Hudson Valley, that Keith Strudler very much likes niche and esoteric things.
No!
Not just music, not just movies, also sports.
Yeah, you're right. I like esoteric sports, like the Tour de France, that's so esoteric that the crowds overwhelm the route every single
time. Here's
how
you know the Tour de France is an esoteric sport.
Because
what
you don't
channel
like
is it broadcast on?
NBC.
No.
Sports.
What?
Now. It's a long race. You can't take up that much block on network.
So I have watched about 2.5 minutes of this year's Tour de France.
Oh, then you're qualified.
And let me explain to the people what occurred in this 2.5 minutes. The leader wears the yellow jersey.
Okay.
His name.
Yes.
Let's just make sure I'm right about all this. His name is Chris Froome.
Yes.
Chris Froome was racing.
You're about to throw up?
Was racing. This is what the Tour de France does to me. Chris Froome was racing in a pack, in the Peloton.
No, he wasn't in the Peloton.
He was not in the Peloton.
He was in a breakaway group.
Oh, I'm sorry. He was in a breakaway group. He was in a smaller group
because
of the larger
the Peloton
group.
Had broken up because they were going up a mountain.
Okay, so they're going up a mountain. Somebody in the middle of this race, the Tour de France is...
It's not in the middle. We're in the last kilometer.
I mean the middle as in it's occurring.
Yes.
Like the race is going on.
Yes.
The Tour de France is the most important and most popular and most difficult cycling race in the world.
Correct. Sure.
This is the Super Bowl of cycling. Right?
I like the way you normalize the sport by comparing it to a sport that you like.
Is it not?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, Chris Froome is biking up a hill.
A mountain. He's not a hill. It's not a hill. A hill is something you see in like an elementary school.
He's pedaling up a slight incline. And
it's like a 20-mile climb.
One of the riders ahead of him.
Someone died on that hill once riding up it.
Of the riders ahead of him crashes into a motorcycle. Fair follow-up question. Why is a motorcycle on the course?
Because they're filming it. There's a lot of reasons. There's medics. They are filming it for tele. How are you going to film it if you don't have got a motorcycle with
drones?
Welcome to 2016 Tour de France.
The drone cannot go that far. You can't have a drone.
Yes,
you can.
No, you can't have a drone go
you
the
ever
whole.
Seen a drone?
Put the remote thing on the chase car in the back.
But you still got a guy in a motorcycle, but he's now carrying a remote control. Why do I want a drone instead of the motorcycle?
Because somebody hit the motorcycle and caused a massive crash.
But that's not the fault of the motorcycle. That's because the crowd, because this supposedly unpopular sport, have so many people that are crowding for literally dozens of miles.
But why aren't they, like, pushed off to the sidelines like in every sporting event ever? They're on the course. I can't buy a ticket to the Super Bowl and go sit on the logo at the 50-yard line.
That's why the Tour de France is better. And they didn't even have to buy a ticket. They just go up there and sit.
So there's this big pileup after a guy hits the motorcycle. Chris Froome gets tangled
weird.
Up in this.
And his bike's
His
destroyed.
Bike is mangled.
Great name, by the way.
Chris Froome?
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like Vroom.
It does look good. It is a good name for a race.
It's a good name.
I'll give you that.
It's like made up.
So he gets tangled up in this crash. His bike is totaled.
And
the leader of the – now, when this happens, there's his team, right? Has a car like
you have cars,
they have replacement bikes.
Yes, but the car you can't get the car up there that quickly
right.
in this kind of crowd.
Right, and that was a problem. The car was like 5 minutes away because of the crowd. So Chris Froome, the leader of the Tour de France, one of the best cyclists on the planet, took off running, started sprinting up the hill,
which is against apparently there's not
Ricky
a.
Bobby.
He had a Talladega Nights moment.
That's Ricky Bobby. It was. Now, I will say, I didn't even think about that. I will say, there's only apparently one rule in the Tour de France, which is you got to have a bike. That is apparently the only real rule, right? It's kind of like soccer. You got one rule, no hands. This is the only rule in cycling.
So Chris Froome just takes off running.
Yep.
And that's okay?
No, it's actually not okay. It's not okay. But what are you going
to
do?
But nothing happened to him.
They came to a decision that because it was in the last kilometer of the race. Now, if this were further back in the race, he would have been able to get back on a bike, and he would have had his teammates help, you know, help him back up to the pack. That wasn't possible because they were at the end of the race. And so they decided, since it was in the last kilometer, and I haven't seen the actual kind of rendering of how they came to this, but apparently they basically took the times there at that point and made that the end of the stage, because that crash, which was no fault of the riders, that was the fault of the tour organizers, that because of that crash, it completely changed the outcome of the race. So they stopped it there, essentially. It would be like a baseball game, you know, basically weather ending, you know, a baseball game. So you take the – if it's at a certain point, you're able to take that as a final score. They did that. We were only a kilometer. Nothing would have really changed. They took the final kind of standings, you know, the person who won the race, they still gave the win. But so they took those times that allowed them to move on in the race without this incident impacting the race. So that's what they had to do. Now, why don't they have more barricades? That's a great question. But you have to – I mean, you're talking about barricading miles and miles and miles. It's really hard.
It's not that hard.
It's really hard.
You ever been on a highway when they're doing construction?
You want to get up there and start barricading the whole thing? You want to wake up at 6 a.m.?
Other people do.
No one does.
People need jobs, Keith.
No
they
one
need jobs.
No one wants to do that. No one wants to do it.
Here's the other thing. Here's how you make the Tour de France watchable.
Okay. Yeah.
So how many stages? 20-something?
Yeah, sorry, 20 stages.
So
you're about to say something I know. It's so stupid.
You got the 20. It's so stupid. It makes it palatable. So the way it's set up now is there's like
you're not going to watch it anyway.
I would watch this second way. So the way it's set up now is there's two types of races, right? There's a time trial, and then what's the other one?
A stage race.
Okay.
There's actually three kinds, but go. Just go.
Three kinds?
Well, there's team time trials.
Oh, good Lord. So the way it works now is like –
the way it works now is if there's – like it's been a changing thing. So the way it's worked since the history of the sport.
So they race – the first day, and then whoever came in first wins that stage, and then they have other people behind them, and then the next day they just start in a big pack again.
Yeah.
Why don't they do it this way?
Okay.
Listen, and I am not in any way diminishing the amazing athleticism it requires to compete in the Tour de France. I think it's one of the more amazing things in sports that someone can put their body through this and endure this. I have all respect in the world for their athleticism.
However. Remember, we have a rule about saying but or however.
I can respect a lot of things that I personally don't want to ever engage with.
Sure.
So, why don't they race the first stage?
Yes.
Whoever wins, say they win by 1 minute. That person, the next day,
gets a 1 minute
starts 1 minute ahead of the person who finished second, who starts 30 seconds ahead of the person who finished third, and they keep racing.
Because they're
and that way people can follow it and track it and know who's
because
in first.
It's not
it blows my mind that the leader can finish 18th in a stage and still be the leader.
You're so dense. Like,
because I want a race to be a race?
No, because first of all, there are a series of individual stage races that make up this larger event. So when you do
that, here we go. I'm going to grab a quick nap.
You'd be ruining the actual sanctity of these individual events. That's A. There are winners of individual events. B, cycling, the strategy of cycling happens when they all ride together in a pack. That's part of the appeal of this.
To who?
You know what? If Rhett Miller, God willing, is listening to this show right now. He literally would say, there's one great guy there, smart, educated, and clearly worldly.
Thanks, Rhett.
No, and then there's some Jerkoff who's sitting there just dissing on everybody, someone who's never accomplished anything and is just waiting for his $3 million check to roll in so he can contribute even less to society than he already does. If possible.
Oh, it's possible.
And I'll tell you what, you get that check tomorrow, you are never volunteering a day in your life. You say you are. Meanwhile, I'm out there swimming to cure cancer and you're doing nothing but criticizing. You can't even understand one of the most important and historic sports.
No, it's really confusing.
It's not.
And really, I'm an educated man.
It's so confusing. They get on bikes. The only place it got confusing was when he started running. That did really seem to defy. I won't lie. That really got it a little.
I think he was confused too.
He seemed like he made a bad decision at that point. I get that. I don't know if you realize the other part. They gave him a bike that had the wrong pedals.
I heard that. They're like, yeah, the bike totally, it was like an impossible bike for him to use.
It's like they gave him a tricycle.
What does that mean?
Well, it had the wrong pedals on it.
How can you have the wrong
pedals? I don't
pedals?
Know what that means either, but he says this like it had the wrong pedals. Like if somebody went and gave like Giancarlo Stanton a 7-iron for the home run derby.
But your shoes only fit into certain pedals. We have to take one last break.
Yeah, but not yet.
We have another segment.
Hey, listen. The grades of the week are going to leave a lot to be desired.
You didn't do any, did you?
I have a few, but they're not as good as this.
We only have 10 minutes. We got to take a commercial.
How?
What?
Why is my idea so ludicrous?
Because
that the Tour de France just be a race. How is that not more compelling and more interesting?
Kevin Lerner favored our tweet about Brett Miller. He didn't think he was creepy. Kevin Lerner.
Yeah, I know he is.
Also from Dallas.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay.
It's not, because that's not what cycling is.
It should be.
It's like having every individual football player out whenever they want, just doing their thing. It's a skills competition at that point.
It's nothing like that. It's like imagine if the 400 meters in the Olympics was contested as 100 meters of sprinting, 100 meters of crab walk, 100 meters of wheelbarrow race. And then 100 meters of speed walking.
I'd watch that.
Of course.
I'd watch that. Can we go to break? We're out of time. You will never get it because you are not sophisticated enough.
I will never get it. That's the other reason I freaking hate cycling, because people are like, well, you don't get it. You just don't understand.
That's right.
You're not part of the club.
No, you
don't understand how someone can finish 27th in a race and still be the leader of that
you'll
race.
You'll never be in this club. You will never be in this club. They'll have a picture of you in the Paris airport saying, do not talk to.
Grades of the week are coming up after this. You're in the classroom, Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. All right, so maybe Dr. Strong was right. We actually did need to go to break when I wanted to yell more about the Tour de France. Anyway, these are your grades of the week.
And now for your grades of the week.
We learned this week that during his free agency debate, Kevin Durant did not talk to a lot of people. But the people that were in his inner circle, specifically Kendrick Perkins, were asked to sign non-disclosure agreements so that they wouldn't go and tell the press anything that Kevin Durant may have confided in them about what he was thinking about, where he was leaning. Kevin Durant made his friends sign non-disclosure agreements to prevent them from going public with details that they spoke about as friends. Keystrel, I feel like this could be something valuable in your life. Great, the idea of one friend making another friend sign an NDA.
I give it an A. In fact, before we leave here, there was some information I may have told you about my personal relationships as per my wife. And I'd like just to get that little something signed before we leave this building. Could be detrimental to my future. So let's go ahead and get that out there. An A. I'd like a copy of that legal document he used. It seems like it must be airtight.
I love hilarious baseball injuries. Jake Diekman is a relief pitcher for the Texas Rangers. The Rangers were recently in Boston, and Jake Diekman, before the game, decided to go sightseeing. Swung by Cheers, right off Boston Common, the bar from the famous TV show. Bought a souvenir mug, as many people might do. Threw that mug in his suitcase. Team traveled to the next destination. He got to his next hotel. Reached into his suitcase. That mug was broken. Mm. Lacerated his finger, and now he's on the disabled list. Grade that injury.
I mean, you know, it's Cheers. So it's important. I get that. You know, I mean, you should know the glass thing. It's just there's things you don't put in your suitcase. Glass.
Snow globes.
Anything that can explode under air pressure, right? Potato chips. Bag gets real big. You just don't. Jars of anything. You just don't do it. Shampoo. You never put shampoo like that unless you wrap it 8 or 9 times.
Yeah, double. You want a plastic bottle in a plastic bag. Absolutely.
So I give that a C-. You should know better.
What's that, Mike Wallace?
I don't think that's how bugs work. They don't expand.
No, but it's glass.
Yeah. You got to pack smarter. And it makes sense. This is a fun episode. It's my fun today.
This is a good episode. And Rhett Miller, if you're listening, ignore my co-host. I'll take care of you.
Thanks to our guest, Rob Boland, Director of the Master of Sports Administration Program at Ohio University, for calling in. Mike Wallace, Dr. Keith Stroller, Director of the Marist College Center for Sports Education. I'm Jeff Rall.
We're in San Francisco most of the week out in Twitter.
We still got a show next week.
Oh, yeah.
You better believe we're back with you next week.
I'll have a lot to talk about.
Don't turn off your radios, friends. You know what's coming up next?
What? Tour de France?
Coverage of the Open Championship.
All right.
Third round action from Troon in Scotland. The leaders should just about be making the turn, getting set for the back nine. So keep it locked right here on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. And we'll see you next week for another 2 hours of your weekly Smart Look at Sports. Thanks for hanging out, everybody. Class is dismissed.